Sorry,
Nert whispered, listening intently. He could hear the aircraft clearly. It was closer. According to the threat assessment system, the aircraft was to the north and would pass by 34 kilometers away. He could also hear Chowdhury calling out on multiple frequencies with no indication the aircraft had heard her. The smart thing to do was to slip back beneath the surface and wait. He wasn't even supposed to be on the surface. As a cadet, he had used family connections to get into action too many times, and his parents had pulled strings to assure he would remain safely aboard the assault carrier. To put himself at further risk would be to go against the wishes of his parents and the operational orders that governed his participation in the invasion. There was grumbling and resentment within the academy that because he had seen action multiple times, he had an advantage over his fellow cadets. Rumors that he was a show-off, a thrill-seeker. The smart thing to do was to stay under the water. On the other hand, he had seen the anguish on the faces of Shauna and Dave. They wanted to know what was happening to their loved ones, and he was worried about the other Mavericks also. They were his friends, far more than any of his fellow cadets. Oh, what the hell, he told himself, remembering a bit of human wisdom Jesse Coulter had told him on Paradise. It is better to act and ask forgiveness than to hesitate and ask permission. Any transgression by him could be attributed to youthful lack of judgment. Sitting up, he set his suit to transmit his ID code over multiple frequencies at full power. Seconds later, his visor displayed a text message from Jates demanding that he cease transmitting. He ignored the message. A second message rephrased the demand as an order, and when he ignored that also, he received notice that his suit's computer had received an override command, killing the transmitter. It didn't matter. The faint, distant drone of engines increased in volume and pitch, and his threat assessment system popped up a window in his visor, warning the aircraft had turned toward him. He was about to attempt to bypass Jates' lockout of his transmitter when a message from Shauna scrolled across the bottom. Run, in case you were wrong. Nert didn't argue with the logic. Splashing out of the water, he ran, leaping up the far side of the stream bank and around over a log, turning to... He froze, grabbing onto a tree to halt his momentum. Without identifying itself, the aircraft was requesting he repeat his ID signal. He couldn't, staring at the sky with a mix of frustration and fear. The enemy would of course request a signal so they could pinpoint his location. Instead, he saw Jates was sending his own ID signal, and Nert felt a pang of guilt. He had been recklessly foolish. If the Verd Chris Sergen was targeted by the enemy, it would be Nert's fault. Then the aircraft painted the area with an active sensor pulse, and the threat warning system of Nert's suit glowed red. He ran. Confirmed, the soldier controlling the drone said as she squinted at the display splashed across her helmet visor. That's a plasma cannon cluster. Perkins examined the same data feed and drew a different conclusion. All I see is trees. That's what you're supposed to see, Jesse said. They bury the plasma cannon hatches just like the lizards did with the maser cannons on Paradise. Switch to the subsurface scan, ma'am. I thought we weren't using active sensors. Sergeant Liu, holding the tablet that guided the drone, spoke without taking her attention off the device she was responsible for. Passive only, Colonel. It's analyzing seismic waves.
Seismic? Perkins expressed surprise. Like earthquakes?
Yes, Liu explained patiently. Seismic waves are always echoing through any planetary body, ma'am, even worlds that don't have tectonic plates. Right now, there is a lot of seismic activity on the continent to work with because of explosions and debris falling from orbit. We are tracking the waves as they pass through the ground, and so can see the waves are passing around an object that is under.
Sergeant, Perkins waved a hand. I trust you. We don't have time for a science lesson. Show me.
Liu transferred the image to the Maverick's leader, who whistled.
Wow, that is a big sumbitch.
That includes the power cells, aiming mechanism, everything the cannon needs, all in that cylinder, Liu noted. We can see there are two other cannons. These clusters always have three cannons.
All right. And you compared this to known profiles of plasma cannons?
Jesse answered the question. Yes. The squids only have two types of these cannons. This is the most common version. No question about it.
We pull back then. Get away from here, contact the fleet upstairs, and get them to make this whole area a smoking crater.
Colonel? Jesse asked.
Let's not be hasty.
The intel provided by the Torgala missed this cannon cluster.
I know that, Coulter.
The fleet needs to...
This might not be the only one they missed, Jesse continued.
Interrupting a senior officer was bad form, but as Perkins herself had said, they didn't have a lot of time.
I mean, what are the odds we found the only one, right?
Perkins cocked her head. Coulter could sometimes be rash, but she had learned to trust his judgment.
You propose to try using the seismic detector to find other cannon clusters?
I propose.
Jesse's Arkansas drawl slipped deeper when he used fancy words.
That we take over this cluster.
He pointed a finger at the ground.
The computers in the control bunker must have a list of other clusters.
Take over?
Perkins stared at the staff sergeant.
Break into this place?
You're going to throw together a plan to do that.
Not break in. We infiltrate.
It's not my plan. It's something the hamsters got from the Torgala.
When she kept staring at him without blinking, he explained.
I studied up on it during the flight here. There wasn't much else to do aboard the Sure Thing.
Look, the squids don't expect these cannons will ever be subjected to a ground assault, which kind of makes sense. They figure if an enemy gets boots on the ground, all the cannons must have been expended or knocked out.
The Torgala found a vulnerability in the design of the control bunkers. They,
Coulter,
show me.
The first drone crashed and burned after its sensors were overwhelmed by passing through the hologram and into the stealth field. The little device did not actually burn, and the crash was a gentle drift down to thump against the ground where it remained after it was determined the drone's computer could not recover from the shock. The second drone flew forward with its external sensors switched off and the computer in safe mode, with guidance by Lou from the ultra-thin wire that spooled out behind the device. She lost the view as it approached the hologram, which from the ground was clearly artificial, glowing and flickering in a way that was disturbing to look at. The failure of the hologram to fool observers on the ground did not matter. The stealth field was intended to conceal the cannon cluster from ships and aircraft at high altitude, and it had performed that task perfectly, since the Ruhar fleet thought they had struck all the cannon clusters. When the drone had traveled a distance estimated to be 80 meters inside the stealth field, Lou commanded the device's computer to restart, and she held it motionless. The drone did not walk, it didn't crawl, and it didn't exactly fly. Mostly, it was a balloon 2 meters long and half a meter in diameter, a miniature zeppelin surrounding a solid core no larger than an apple. The balloon maneuvered by sucking in air and puffing it out, propelled by turbines that turned slowly so they made little sound. With sensors back online, Lou still could not see much. The blackness inside the stealth field was nearly complete. Nearly. A stealth field bent light around it, and light bent around a starship simply went around the field and continued onward into empty space. When light from the sky bent around a stealth field on the ground, the light could not keep going. It would create a brightly glowing ring around the bottom of the field and negate the effect of stealth, unless something was done to absorb the light. That is why ground-based stealth fields had a ring of photon-absorbing material at the bottom, where the photons were converted into heat and transferred to sinks deep underground. Sergeant Liu was able to direct the drone because the light-absorbing ability of the ring was not perfect, so inside there was a dim bluish glow saturating the dome of the field.
We're in, Lou whispered to whoever was listening, directing her words to Staff Sergeant Coulter.
It was his plan they were implementing, despite his protests that he was only following an idea cooked up by the Torgala.
4 meters to the left, he directed softly. Down. Bring it down. Watch the trees, those branches. I see it.
Lou kept the irritation she felt from reflecting in her voice.
I don't see.
There.
Jesse leaned in, tapping the screen of the tablet she was using to steer the drone.
See those rocks leaning together? There's a thing, looks like a big mushroom. That's an air intake.
You are sure about this, Coulter?
Perkins glanced left and right. They were in a dense thicket of brush that provided good cover, but also would be tough to run through even in powered armor.
Eh, she told herself, if the enemy knew of their presence, they would likely send a missile, and no powered armor could outrun that.
I'm just going by—
I know, you're relying on what the Torgula reported. They never did this for real, did they?
They never had to, he replied.
They never got the opportunity.
Plasma cannons are one-shot weapons. Once they're expended, there's no point risking a ground team to take one out. We know CN-20 works because the Ruhar have tested it.
Tested under controlled conditions, not in the field.
Perkins did not like the idea of deploying nerve gas, which is what CN-20 was, despite what the Ruhar called it. The manual described the gas as a non-toxic and non-lethal substance that was safe and legal to use on the battlefield. It was binary, meaning the gas was dispersed in two parts that only became effective when they bound together in the bloodstream and only affected Wergalan biochemistry. Separately, the two gases were expected to pass through Wergalan filters without detection by hazard sensors. Using lethal chemical weapons was a violation of the treaty between the Ruhar and Kristang, and although a certain amount of cheating was tolerated and even expected, if the CN-20 killed the crew in the bunker, humans would be blamed. She had only assurances from the Ruhar that the gas would incapacitate, not kill. The question was not whether she trusted the intel provided by the Torgula. Those aliens had been wrong about many important details, but most of the data they gave to the Ruhar was solid. The question was, did she trust the Ruhar? The AI system of the command bunker had detected the helicopter approaching, though sensor coverage of that area was poor, so it only had an intermittent view of the event. It had been surprised when the helicopter flew straight into the restricted area, then astonished when the aircraft flew into and out of the stealth field, making the AI wonder just what idiot jackass was flying the darn thing. That the big helicopter had survived the event was a miracle, but the AI knew the craft had survived only because its seismic sensors did not detect an impact after it lost sight of the awkward flying machine. The AI, and its fellows at other cannon clusters, had repeatedly warned that having a sensor array which only pointed up was a dangerous vulnerability. The biological beings who created and governed the AI repeatedly rejected the warning, with the justification that plasma cannons would be shooting only at objects in the sky above, and the threat of a ground-based assault was extremely unlikely. When the AIs pointed out that there was minimal expense involved in providing sensor coverage of the ground around a cannon cluster, the biological beings responded that they already knew that. They did not need a computer telling them how to do their jobs and shut the hell up. The AIs did shut the hell up. They didn't like it. The AI of that particular cannon cluster warned the crew of the bunker about the helicopter, which caused a brief bit of excitement. Then the crew went back to waiting and waiting and waiting. It bothered the AI that it had lost track of the helicopter. The aircraft was below the lower limit of sensor coverage and ducked behind a hill after it passed through the stealth field. For a short time, seismic sensors recorded the heavy whop, whop, whop of the helicopter's rotor blades, making the ground vibrate. Then that also was gone, and the AI had no idea where the mysterious aircraft had gone. It warned the crew that the aircraft was an unknown potential threat, causing the crew to mute future threat notifications. What they were concerned about was the fleet of Ruhar battleships hanging over their heads, and the terrifying knowledge that somehow the enemy had known the exact location of most cannon clusters in the network. The AI observed a slight change of pressure in one of the concealed air intakes, and a scan did not reveal anything other than an increase of humidity. It was known that water vapor could be a useful carrier for dangerous substances, and the AI could have warned the crew of the potential danger, except it was not programmed to do that. The Wergalan did not like their AIs to think for themselves. They were limited to doing what they were told. When the three crew members wavered in their chairs, began trembling, and collapsed forward unconscious onto their consoles, the AI could have sent out a warning that the bunker had been compromised, but, as it wasn't programmed to do that, it did nothing. It also did nothing when the codes of the heavy bunker door were cracked and the door swung open, because that was not within its narrow scope of responsibilities. When the bunker's internal sensors gave a view of aliens warily entering the ramp from the outer door into the bunker, the AI could have sent out a general warning because it interpreted its responsibilities broadly. It did not send out a general alert for one simple reason. Curiosity. The aliens were humans, a new and strange species it had only vague information about. The AI waited and watched and experienced a measure of admiration for the invading aliens. The few reports it had read about humans all stated the creatures were weak, primitive, and no threat. Apparently, they were also inventive and clever. What the hell, the AI told itself. I just have to know what happens next. I'll be damned, Jesse whispered when the bunker door began to swing open. It actually worked. Perkins shook her head. You expected it wouldn't work? She demanded. I figured it was worth trying, you know, but damn. Metzger, send in the creeper drones. Everyone? He aimed his rifle at the opening exposed as the door ponderously swung back, selecting rockets. Look sharp. Chapter 22. The platoon advanced through the city, one squad leapfrogging the other, and with Danny always escorted by Humphrey. They moved quickly as they could, with the complication that they increasingly encountered small groups of frightened civilians who were just trying to get out of the city. The aliens walked, or Danny thought of the motion as scuttling, moving along on their creepy tentacle legs. The streets were jammed with vehicles that had either lost power or lost guidance when the city's control grid failed. Cars, trucks, and buses had smashed into each other, into light posts, buildings, or anything their inventive drivers could find to crash into. Some vehicles, trapped behind accidents that could not be cleared, had simply been abandoned, their former occupants now making their way out of the city on foot, or on tentacle. Most were just terrified civilians, and Danny reminded her soldiers they were not to fire unless fired upon. We are the invaders here, she reminded herself. We are the aliens, the bad guys. This is their planet, and we're taking it away from them. Hell, she thought with seriously conflicted emotions. We humans and Verds are not even going to keep the place. We're just hired guns for the Achakai. This, she concluded, sucked. Link up with 3rd Platoon, get them out of the city, and then wrestle with a moral crisis, she told herself. I have a job to do. That job became more difficult when the scouts reached a sort of plaza where 3 major streets intersected. Vehicles were burning, and it looked like the cause of the fires was not just accidental crashes. They had holes from bullets or shrapnel. For a moment, she hoped that 3rd Platoon had engaged in a firefight in the plaza. Then she saw a smashed and burning part of an aircraft that had fallen and skidded along the street, battering cars until it struck a fountain in the middle of the plaza and came to rest there. The debris was so twisted and charred, she couldn't tell if the aircraft had been friend or foe, and it really didn't matter. What did matter were the dozen screaming Wargalan civilians who panicked when they saw the skin-suit-wearing enemy running along toward the plaza. The civilians shouted and pointed and ran, and that attracted the attention of 2 local police officers who were trying to get the city's residents calmed down, organized, and moving toward the street-level openings to the underground railways that were still running. As soon as the police saw the platoon's scouts, Danny's plan to take a side street and go around the plaza literally went up in flames. The police had weapons that they fired wildly, missing the scouts and striking a truck on a street that led into the plaza. That truck had escaped damage when the aircraft crashed into the plaza, so it was just stuck with no place to go forward or back. When the police fired their weapons, they struck the back of the truck, and there was a high-pitched hissing sound. An orange cloud vented from the truck only for a second, and boom! An explosion rocked the plaza, sending the body of the truck into the air to crash down on several cars. Danny was knocked to her knees, rolling backwards, pushing away Humphrey, who tried to shield the captain with her body. I'm fine, dammit, Danny protested. Bessalt, what's going on? The Surgeon didn't answer immediately. She heard gunfire that she knew was the bark of Kristang rifles, interspersed with the quieter pops of the machine pistols carried by the local police. Ceasefire,
Besalt called. We've got two down.
Checking her visor, she saw that two of their scouts were down. Not just down, one of them was dead. The other had sustained serious injury to his left arm and leg. Shit. What should she do? Bringing the injured soldier with them would slow the platoon down, and they couldn't afford to. Besalt solved the problem for her.
Captain, we need to keep moving. I've assigned two from my squad to take care of Tobinex.
Two soldiers down, two staying behind with the injured soldier, and they still hadn't linked up with the third platoon. She eye-clicked on the icon for Tobinex, ITC, in her visor. The medical status of the Verdcris Infantry 3rd Class was serious, but his suit considered the injuries survivable, assuming he was not asked to do anything strenuous. How many injured did 3rd Platoon have? Negative, she heard herself saying. One soldier stays with Tobinex.
Captain?
Besalt. You heard me. We're under strength as it is. The platoon was under strength, and she had already detailed soldiers to escort the pilots and those people injured in the dropship crash. If she kept siphoning off personnel, they would not have enough manpower to assist 3rd Platoon. Their combat power had been depleted by three just in a brief firefight with two local police. Her soldiers were having to fire warning shots to keep the panicked Wargalin civilians back. The crowd was not rushing at them, but in the smoke and confusion, no one knew where to go. Bodies of locals were splayed in the plaza, their unprotected bodies faring badly in the explosion. The whole rescue mission was, she had begun to suspect, an ill-conceived idea. She had no business leading an infantry unit. Yet there she was. Much as she hated to consider it, perhaps it was best to cut their losses and pull back. She didn't know whether the third even existed at that point. Telleret, she called to their communications specialist. Try to contact the third again. Danny made up her mind right there. If they could not establish contact, she was pulling her people out. The city would only get more dangerous the farther toward the urban center they traveled.
Ma'am, Telleret answered. Nothing on suit comms.
That's it then.
But there's a local telecom station on the other side of the plaza. I might be able to use that to boost the signal,
the soldier suggested. Danny ground her teeth.
Get on it, then.
The platoon dashed across the plaza, if dashing involved slow stepping around and in some cases over smashed vehicles. Each time she approached a truck, she experienced a flare of anxiety, not knowing if that vehicle would also explode. Nothing exploded, and the local civilians dispersed, running in every direction except toward the platoon. Telleret moved as quickly as she could. Not fast enough for Danny.
If it's not working,
got it. Think I got it. Ma'am, I'm going to send a message out. See if anyone responds.
Do it.
The transmission could attract attention. The wrong kind.
Danny bit her lip. She knew that. The Verds did not need to treat her like a dumbass civilian.
Do it. Besalt, Alphex, get ready to run like hell.
A minute later, with the platoon anxiously watching the sky for incoming ordnance, even Telleret was about to give up, when an encrypted text message was received. Danny's suit couldn't understand the message. Her suit didn't have Verdcris encryption keys. Wonderful way to work with allies, she grimaced.
Anyone got that?
Alphex answered.
It's the authentication code for the third and their coordinates. Captain, they're less than a kilometer from here, but we've been going in the wrong direction. They are toward the city center from here.
Lead on.
Wait.
Telleret, can you use that thing to send a message to anyone else?
I can try, ma'am.
Great.
Danny recorded a brief report of what happened to their dropship, that she had taken her platoon into the city and why, and their location. It would be a miracle if anyone in the Legion received the message, but she had to try.
Send this.
Done. I think. There is no way to get an acknowledgement.
Understood.
All right, we are out of here.
Alphex.
She was interrupted by rifle fire, the heavy bark of the platoon's Kristang rifles and the higher-pitched popping of Wargalin rounds. Reflexively, she ducked as rounds struck the wall in front of her and exploded, stitching a line down and toward her until she heard the whoosh sound of a Kristang rocket and the incoming fire cut off with an explosion she felt through her boots.
The enemy!
Someone shouted.
They're behind us!
No shit, Denny thought.
Alphex, we're moving.
Scrambling to her feet, she crouched and ran. They had no choice but to continue onward, deeper into the city. Jates was last to be winched up aboard the hovering dropship. He was barely in the door when the ship began moving. Hovering used prodigious amounts of fuel and made trees sway underneath the craft. The Dodo was in stealth, but the field didn't extend far enough to mask the shaking leaves and branches. If enemy sensors were looking in that direction, the dropship's position would be revealed. Because the stealth effect bent light to wrap it around the dropship, it was utterly dark inside the field, and Jates couldn't see anything until there was a dim glow from lights inside the cabin. Barely seen hands reached out to steady him and released the winch cable. He gripped handholds with both hands until the ship's acceleration smoothed out and the door behind him slid shut. Then he was inside the cabin that held six members of the assassin's cult, and all of them were staring not at the three humans or the Ruhar cadet, but at him.
I have never met one of you, Anachakai said to him.
Jates swung up the faceplate of his helmet and glared at the assassin.
You have never met a soldier?
The assassin blinked.
No, one of you. The ones who submit to your females. The Verd, Chris, as you call yourselves, he spat and squinted at Jates, examining the Surgeon's face closely. Are you really a male of your kind? I have heard that it is difficult to see the difference between your neutered males and your females. They are the same as...
Jates clenched his fist so hard the armor creaked.
It will be difficult for you to see anything after I tear off your head and shove it up your ass.
What?
You...
Urshkov,
another Achakai roared.
Surgeon Third Class Jates is a soldier and our ally on this operation. You will apologize to him and treat him with respect, or I will tear off your head.
Apology, Surgeon, Urshkov bowed his head. This is all strange to me. I am sorry if you are insulted.
By you? Jates snorted. If I can ever be insulted by anything you say, I will kill myself.
He turned to the other assassin and patted the stock of his rifle.
Are we going to have a problem?
No, the Achakai leader bowed his head in a curt gesture. Your people are considered to be without honor, traitors to Kristang society. My people have always been without honor, and now we too are traitors.
Only if you lose, Dave spoke.
That is true, the assassin agreed. If we win here, the Achakai can become a clan and write our own rules.
Until then, Jates relaxed slightly. We are both traitors without honor.
According to the warrior caste, Shauna added. The Achakai leader nodded.
Yes, according to the warrior caste.
Then fuck them, Shauna said. That apparently translated well, for the assassin leader laughed. While Jates spoke with the Achakai, both sides still wary of each other, Shauna turned her attention to Nert, scolding him.
You should not have sent your ID code without authorization. That was a stupid thing to do.
Sorry,
he replied, his already pink skin blushing in the helmet.
You are not sorry. That's the problem.
She wagged a finger at him, realizing what she was doing, and put her hand down.
Oh my God, I'm turning into my mother, she thought.
Don't do it again.
I won't.
She wanted to say thank you, but that would be sending a mixed signal. We rely on the chain of command, you understand that? Without it, we're just people with guns. We're not an army.
I understand.
Stung, he looked to the back of the cabin where Chowdhury was removing her suit legs.
Does Miss Chowdhury need help?
Chaika is helping her, and you should address her as Corporal Chowdhury, Shauna said. Technically, Chowdhury's rank in the Indian Army was Naik, but UNEF had standardized on using NATO rank codes, and an OR-6 was the equivalent in the U.S. military to either corporal or specialist. Sometimes, being part of an international force, an interspecies force, gave Shauna a headache.
Nerdy, I know you want to help, and you are brave and smart. Too smart to do stupid things. What Jaitz said before is true. We need to think not only about the mission objectives, but how our actions affect our peoples. If you get killed down here, your government will blame humans or the Verds.
They should blame the idiots in the fleet.
He jabbed a finger at the ceiling.
They missed an entire layer of strategic defense.
Nert, if an operation fails, there is always plenty of blame to cover everyone involved. Okay. Go help Chowdhury.
Shauna saw the other woman grimace in pain. Stepping forward, she nodded to Jaitz.
Where are we going?
The Achakai leader answered instead.
We are going where our furry friends,
he pointed toward the closed cockpit door.
Take us. Greetings, Staff Sergeant Jared. I am Squad Leader Ditzak.
He gave her a human-style salute, though with the palm facing forward. That is interesting, Shauna thought as she returned the gesture, U.S. Army style with her palm down.
I wonder where the ninjas learned that. Do you know where the hamsters are going next?
Her use of slang for the Ruhar was a deliberate effort to build camaraderie with the Achakai, a we are all oppressed by our Ruhar overlord's sense of determination.
They told us they are looking for the crew of a dropship that launched from the Tig McDonough shortly after that ship broke in half. It was reportedly the last dropship to get away.
The last one?
Jaitz knew what she was thinking.
You hope it might be the ship that carried Colonel Perkins? And Coulter, of course, he added.
It's possible.
It is possible, he agreed. I also hope they survived.
Shauna just then realized what had been bothering her. Something that was missing. All six of the Achakai were in combat suits with full battle rattle. They did not have a medic with them. That was why Dave was helping Chowdhury as best he could.
This is not a Sarbert? Search and rescue?
No, Ditzak expressed surprise. We are an assault unit. We were diverted when it was discovered that our primary target was abandoned and destroyed by the enemy.
So you didn't come down here looking for us?
The pilots did not tell us anything, Ditzak shrugged. They do not trust us.
Jaitz's eyes narrowed.
Do you trust them?
Ha! The Achakai leader laughed bitterly.
The furry ones are renowned across the galaxy for their treachery.
After the events on Fresno, Shauna couldn't argue with that.
We need to talk with the pilots.
They refuse to speak with us, Ditzak warned.
Shauna stepped forward to the bulkhead behind the cockpit, holding onto seatbacks as the dropship bounced through turbulent air.
They will talk with me.
Swinging up her faceplate, she mashed a thumb down on the intercom button.
This is Staff Sergeant Shauna Jared of the Mavericks. I need to send a message.
It's establishing a handshake, ma'am,
Sergeant Liu reported excitedly. The undertone of surprise in her voice told Perkins the soldier had not expected the clutch-together system to work. The bunker had a powerful, secure communication system, but it was only capable of talking to other bunkers in the network. Liu was using a feature of the system that was designed to identify approaching aircraft, using it as a receiver and transmitter. It was low bandwidth and operated on low power, and she wasn't sure the connection between the Wergalan gear and their Legion equipment would work.
Got it. She pumped a fist in the air. We're receiving a Legion-wide message. Pretty standard stuff. It's like...
Liu looked up, realizing the CO should be reading the messages.
It should be synced to your tablet, Colonel.
Perkins grunted as she scrolled through garbled, uninformative, and out-of-date message traffic. None of it was addressed to her, other than the all-units-on-the-ground report status. Yeah, she thought bitterly. We've been trying to do that. Sitting down, she typed a short message to General Ross, tagged it as priority with her ID code, and hit send, then scrolled through the messages again. As she suspected, the first wave was scattered all over the continent. It was impossible for her to understand the overall strategic situation without access to the Legion datanet.
No way I can send a query from here?
No, ma'am, sorry. Text or voice only, no data.
The Legionette wouldn't trust a query sent from this gear. She shook her head. Perkins waited with increasing anxiety, checking every few seconds for a reply from Ross's staff. After 5 minutes, still nothing. The simple-minded AI of the Legion's secure command-level comm system should have at least sent back an acknowledgement that her message had been received. She sent the message again, and waited. General Ross did not have enough time for the most vital tasks he was responsible for. Certainly not time to worry about or even notice personnel issues. Still, the human eye is attracted to movement. And while on the conference call with Admiral Kuhn, he kept seeing with the corner of his eye a commotion on the other side of the communications compartment. A Chinese major on his staff was engaged in a heated and animated discussion with an Indian captain, and they both kept glancing at Ross. It was distracting and annoying, and he was annoyed with himself both for not better disciplining his staff and for allowing himself to be distracted. As soon as the mostly useless conference call ended, he stood up from the secure terminal and approached the two officers, who both wore guilty looks.
Ling, Ross addressed the major while glancing meaningfully at his wristwatch. What is going on?
It's nothing, General, Ling replied, waving his hand in a dismissive gesture. The enemy is attempting to spoof our communications. The captain, seated at the console, tugged her ponytail and looked at Ross with such anxiety he felt sorry, despite his annoyance.
What is it, Captain?
Ling glared at the junior officer.
It is nothing. I asked the captain, Ross snapped, his patience having run out. So?
He stole a look at her name tag. With the Legion expanding, he couldn't remember everyone's name.
Patharker? He recited her name.
Captain Patharker looked between Major Ling, who was her immediate superior, and who she worked with on a daily basis, and General Ross, who she had rarely spoken to. The stern expression on the general's face made the decision for her.
General, we might have received a message from Lieutenant Colonel Perkins.
What? When? Ross demanded. Why am I only hearing about this now?
Ling spoke before Patharker could answer.
It's spoofing, sir. The message came through a Wagalan source. They're trying to get us to respond so they can track our location, Ling said, like explaining nuclear physics to a 5-year-old. It is a...
Ross held up a hand to cut Ling off.
You don't think that is true, Captain?
It could be spoofing, sir, she admitted. But the authentication code is correct. Also, she looked away, embarrassed. The content of the message feels real. I have worked with Colonel Perkins. This sounds like her.
That was enough for Ross, who made a cutting motion with one hand to tell another staffer that his next call could wait.
Show me the message.
Ling was a cybersecurity expert, having been trained by the Ruhar. Ross had to trust his knowledge and experience. If the Wargalan had indeed hacked Legion authentication codes, then sending a reply along the same channel could pinpoint Ross's location and doom his people to a missile strike. On the other hand, it would take 2 seconds to read the message and decide for himself. The message was brief, reading, Sir, I have been unavoidably delayed. What the fuck is going on? Your most humble and obedient servant, Emily Perkins.
Oh, Mike, that is Perkins, all right. It can't be anyone else. When did we receive this? Ross demanded.
Patharker lost all her hesitancy, sure of herself again.
The first message was
first. There is more than one?
Ling explained, chastened.
The first message was intercepted by the AI and put into a buffer. When it was received a second time, the AI kicked it up for review as a possible spoofing threat. Patharker only saw it a few minutes ago. I was going to dismiss it. Sorry.
Not your fault.
Ross was irritated neither of them had actually answered his question.
When did we?
Ling realized his mistake.
23 minutes ago.
Ross leaned over Patharker's shoulder.
Is this channel text only?
We can do voice, sir.
Her fingers flew over the console.
Transfer it to my station, he ordered as he strode across the compartment.
After sending the message a second time,
Perkins had resisted Lou's suggestion to put the message on repeat. If the Wargalan were paying attention, they might be suspicious about why a message on their network was repeating, and look at that message. If they did, and she had to assume the enemy had an AI somewhere that was monitoring communications, the enemy would quickly see that the message was encrypted using a Legion scheme, and that would draw unwanted attention. So she sent a different message out, hoping it would be picked up by a ship overhead. All they could do was wait. Wait and try to gain control over the cluster of plasma cannons.
"Colonel," Lou called, waving for attention.
"I think we're in."
"Already? How can you—"
"It's not me."
Lou pointed to the sleek gray slab case of electronics on a console next to her. It was a gift from the Giraptha to the Mavericks, the reason they had so easily been able to open the bunker door.
"This fancy doodad we got from the Giraptha."
"Doodad?"
Despite the seriousness of the situation, Perkins had to smile.
"Did I not use the slang correctly? I meant, a device beyond our understanding."
"Doodad is the right word."
Using technology provided by a patron species was technically against the unwritten rules of warfare, unless the tech was operated by a patron species for their own benefit. So obtaining the computer from the Giraptha was cheating, although ironically there was no rule against stealing and copying tech from advanced species, so screw the rules, as far as Perkins was concerned. Lou nodded.
"I don't know what we paid for it, but don't ask. Also, don't ever mention it to anyone."
"I truly wouldn't know what to tell them. We don't know how it works.
This thing—"
She tapped the featureless gray slab with a fingertip, feeling it had become warm to the touch.
"Not only established a connection to the Wargalan system and cracked their encryption, it looks like we're in. I have admin privileges, Colonel."
"Show me."
Lou pulled up a menu on her own laptop, with the Wargalan controls replicated in English characters. Perkins saw that on a small window in the corner of the screen, Lou had the same menu in Chinese characters.
"Whew,"
Perkins whistled.
"Is that the firing sequence?"
"Yes."
Lou lifted her hands off the touchscreen, afraid she might touch the wrong icon.
"Over here," she pointed to another menu, "is the targeting system."
Perkins reached for her own tablet.
"Can you sync that to me?"
"Already did that, ma'am. It looks like there's a tutorial."
Over the next 10 or so minutes, Perkins toggled through the menu, then scanned the tutorial. She had to snort with a laugh at the presentation. Whatever group of Wargalan put together the tutorial, they must have used their own military's version of PowerPoint. It even had annoying, cheesy-looking clip art that made her roll her eyes. Lou was wrong. It was not exactly a tutorial, for the file did not contain operational details. It was a presentation for high-level officials or for new trainees. She finished the file around the same time Lou did.
"Think you can dig into this?"
"I could try."
Lou's eyes reflected a combination of eager anticipation and fear.
"Ma'am, once I try to activate anything with the cannons—"
"Yes, we'll attract attention.
Work on the targeting system first. We may have another problem."
"What's that?"
"Look at slide 19. It shows communications nodes connecting to 44 other cannon clusters."
"Yes?"
Lou didn't understand.
"The intel the Ruhar got from the Torgala said there were only 38 clusters. That's how many the pre-invasion bombardment took out."
"Shit."
Lou's face turned pale.
"Yeah."
Perkins studied the slide, trying to see if there was a hint at the location of the other nodes.
"Besides us here, there are 5 other clusters the 7th Fleet doesn't know about. The Wargalan are saving them for the second wave."
Lou turned her attention back to the alien console.
"I will try to find their locations."
Behind her, Perkins heard Lou suck in a breath.
"Oh, ma'am, you have a message from General Ross."
Perkins stiffened, aware the message might be from a Wargalan cybersecurity team.
"Authenticated?"
"Yes, the code checks out."
"Send it to me, and keep it in your sandbox."
A second later, she knew the message was real.
It read simply, "Humble and Obedient Servant Bullshit. Ross."
"Give me voice comms." Perkins synced her earpiece to the tablet. "Good morning, General."
There was a split-second pause while the voice signal was recorded, encrypted, compressed, and sent out in a burst. Then, "It's afternoon here, Perkins. Where the hell have you been? We saw your dropship got out, but then lost track of it."
"It got shot down. We bailed out."
"Hold where you are. I'll send a SAR bird."
"We're not there anymore, sir. We found a helicopter and flew it here."
"A helicopter? So that was you?"
"It's a long story."
There was a longer pause. Ross knew that "found a helicopter" really meant killed squids and took the helicopter from them. He didn't need the details right then. "Where are you now?"
"We're in the control center of a Wergalan plasma cannon cluster, one the Ruhar don't know about."
"Sir, we are confident we have access to the cannons." A longer pause, then a sigh. "Of course you do. Perkins, nobody likes a show-off."
"My apologies. I will strive to achieve less in the future."
"I didn't tell you to do that. Find a balance, maybe. The Ruhar are grading us on a curve, and you're making the rest of us look bad."
"Sir, we have a problem."
"Other than you found a plasma cannon the Ruhar didn't know about?"
"Yes. It looks like there might be 5 other clusters down here that the 7th Fleet missed."
Yet another pause. "Perkins, when did you decide to become the Bad News Fairy?"
"Being the Tooth Fairy seemed like a career dead end, sir."
"Ha! Shit. I need to tell our fuzzy friends about this minor development. They'll want to delay landing the second wave. We're getting our asses kicked down here, and not just because we lost 2 assault transports. The intel the Ruhar had is wrong. We got 40, maybe 50% more opposition than we expected."
"It's a fair fight now?"
"That's what I'm afraid of. Is there any way you can identify the location of the other plasma cannons?"
"Working on it."
Another heavy sigh. "Work faster."
"Sir."
There was a catch in her throat, and she had to swallow before she could speak.
"Is there any news about the rest of my team? The other dropship?"
"No, nothing yet." He decided not to tell her about the anomalous cargo pod. "Don't give up hope. I thought you were dead."
"There were a couple of times when I thought I was dead too."
"Right. You really think you can fire those cannons?"
"We're looking into the targeting system now. I know, we need to work faster."
"You may be our ace in the hole."
"Sir, these cannons are a single-shot weapon. If we're using this one, it has to be for a damned good reason."
"I'll keep that in mind. Anything else?"
"Yes. Please inform Admiral Cacrondo that I discovered secret weapons that could threaten his ships. I sort of promised to do that. Didn't think it would ever happen," she added.
"I will inform the good Admiral myself. Perkins?"
"Sir?"
"It is really good to hear from you."
Chapter 23
"General Ross,"
Admiral Kuhn put the best "I am being polite" tone in his voice, knowing it wouldn't be translated perfectly.
"I understand your concerns."
"Admiral," Ross replied in an "I don't think you do understand" tone. "It's simple. Either we land the second wave or we pull our people off the surface. The situation down here is unsustainable." He meant that literally. The Legion was expending ammunition at a prodigious rate, with no firm schedule for resupply. His remaining air assets had been forced onto the defensive, unable to provide air support to the ground troops. His aircraft were also running low on fuel and ammunition, with some gunships having expended all their missiles.
"An extraction under fire is more dangerous to the fleet than—"
"I know that, General. The safety of the fleet is not my only concern. If the assault transports are hit while landing the second wave, the invasion will fail, and we will not have enough assets to pull your forces off the surface. We are considering all options. It would help if Colonel Perkins could identify the location of the other plasma cannon clusters."
"Her team is working on it." Ross wanted to add, "That is more than you furry idiots are doing." He did not say that aloud.
"Contact me if they make any progress. Kuhn out."
The Admiral immediately turned to his waiting staff.
When will the assault carriers be ready to land the second wave?
Operations Officer Wogolin answered.
The Earl Mechadon and Tol Brandaru are completing repairs. Their boarding operation has been delayed.
Delayed how long? Kuhn asked, irritated.
That information should have already been provided to him.
As yet unknown, Wogolin grimaced. The Mechadon has a radiation leak, serious enough to evacuate the aft section of the hull. They are working to
instruct the Mechadon to eject the leaking reactor and commence boarding.
Admiral, the ops officer replied with a patient, we already thought of that tone.
The Mechadon also has ruptured power conduits. The portside launching bays are operating on auxiliary power. Defensive shields in that section are at 30% and dropping. Their engineering team believes that by the time they have bypassed the ruptured conduits, they will also have the radiation leak contained.
The radiation leak has delayed boarding, but the conduit issue has not? Kuhn asked.
Yes. Sir, ejecting the reactor will reduce boarding time by only 14 minutes. The Mechadon's captain has not taken that step because she has not received a timeline for landing the second wave.
Kuhn got the message. He should not be asking his people to cut corners when he had no idea when or if the second wave would be authorized to land.
Very well. What is the issue with the Brandaru?
A cracked bank of jump drive coils. They are draining the charged coils before they can work to connect the remaining coil sets into a bank with enough power for 3 jumps.
Kuhn nodded once. The Brandaru was performing the hazardous work on the coils far from the loaded transport ships in case the damaged coils exploded. Again, he could not fault the crew's judgment or zeal to get back into action.
It's a good thing we aren't ready to give a go-ahead for the second wave.
He walked over to the tactical plot in the center of the operations theater.
Any update on the mystery contact?
Wogolin was uncomfortable.
The destroyers are continuing to pursue the contact. They lost the trail and have not been able to find it again.
Following the costly battle against the second ring of strategic defense satellites, a damaged destroyer had been authorized to jump away and act as an outer sensor picket, while the crew worked to effect repairs. While drifting through empty space, the ship flew through a dispersed cloud of low-level radiation, the type of cloud that was caused when a starship vented reactor plasma. Kuhn had ordered 2 destroyers to investigate and hopefully locate what he suspected was a Wergalan ship lurking in stealth and acting as a forward observer.
Has analysis of the cloud been completed? Kuhn asked, his attention focused on the tactical plot.
The situation was serious, but not dire. He had 4 fully operational battleships, with another 2 having jumped away to repair battle damage. As long as Kuhn had 4 powerful battleships, the Wergalan would not challenge for control of space around the planet. The enemy could send ships in to conduct raids on the assault carriers while they landed the second wave, and battleships were not the right platform for pursuing raiders. Finding and killing a forward observer could buy precious seconds in a battle.
Not yet, Admiral. The cloud does not match the signature of any Wergalan ship that we or the Torgala know of.
Kristang, then? Kuhn guessed.
No, sir. The closest match, our best guess, is a Bosphorok ship.
Bos? Kuhn didn't complete his thought. Are they sure?
They can't be certain, because our database on the Bosphorok is incomplete. The ratio of isotopes in the clouds points to a Bosphorok origin. The data could be wrong.
The possibility of a patron species warship lurking around the battle space changed the strategic situation. Changed it in favor of the enemy.
Send a cruiser. No, 2 cruisers to pursue the contact.
Admiral, even 2 cruisers will not...
I'm not intending to throw them into battle against the Bosphorok. I do want the birds to know we are serious about tracking them.
Force their hand? Wogolin guessed.
Exactly. They can engage or clear the battle space. Detach a frigate to contact our Jarapha friends.
The Beatles have told us they can't risk getting involved unless...
I'm not asking them to come to our rescue, Kuhn explained impatiently. We will ask them to analyze the data we collected about that cloud. The Jirapatha database surely can tell us whether the mystery ship is Bosphorak or not.
He was hoping there was another possibility. A Wargalan ship having dumped overboard a false plasma cloud that had a signature similar in nature to one of their patron ships. If so, that was a clever way to distract the Ruhar fleet and delay, possibly cancel, the arrival of the second wave. A second layer of SD satellites the Torgala had known nothing about. Additional clusters of plasma cannons that, again, had not been hinted at in the intel reports. Now, the possibility of an advanced technology warship waiting to interfere in the battle. What else could go wrong?
What's up? Jesse asked, slinging his rifle and stretching his arms over his head to relieve the cramps in his neck and shoulders. Combat skin suits were amazing technology, keeping the wearer warm or cold as desired. They were also tiring to wear for extended periods. In the underground control center, Perkins had authorized the platoon to remove their helmets, with the warning that helmets had to be attached to suit belts and readily available. When the helmet was worn, the weight on it pressed down on the inflatable collar around the neck. Clipped to the attachment point on the belt, the helmet's weight tugged down the left shoulder, and it was in the way no matter what Jesse wanted to do. He was tempted to put it back on, but then his team would see that as a signal they should do the same. So he dealt with the discomfort and focused on his job, which at the moment was nothing. That was why he had wandered over to the station where Lou was working, curious what she was doing. Staff Sergeant? Lou looked up from her laptop, acknowledging him with a curt, distracted nod.
You heard about the other plasma cannons?
I heard there was a possibility, Jesse emphasized the last word.
You're trying to identify their locations?
Yes. So far, no joy. The level I have access to sort of assumes we already have that information, which makes sense, she grimaced.
Frustrating, huh?
You have no idea.
I kind of think I do, Jesse assured her.
What's the next step?
I don't know. Like I told the colonel, I could query the system, but that requires me to have a higher level of access. That is sure to raise flags on the Wargalan network. So would a query for information we should already have.
Don't do that, then, Jesse agreed.
He pointed to her laptop.
That looks like some kind of targeting system.
Yes, Perkins asked me to verify whether we really have control of the cannons in this cluster. I can't do that without activating the cannons, and that's another thing that would bring attention to us. So we're trying to see if we can get the targeting system to work. We should be able to track targets without alerting the network.
Jesse studied the display. The English language characters overlaying the alien symbol made for a jarring image. The user interface made no sense to him, but it wasn't supposed to. Something about the symbols drew his attention. Lou had the targeting sensors pointing almost straight up, looking at mostly empty sky. There were small dots that he assumed were Ruhar or Achakai starships. Each ship was ringed by a purple circle with a tiny script of out of range below.
What's the orange shaded area on the horizon?
That shows the area where the cannons are ineffective, because a low angle shot like that causes the plasma to travel through too much atmosphere. By the time the bolts get into space, they have degraded and dispersed.
Okay. And the yellow shaded areas above that?
Like the orange no-shoot area, a band of yellow covered 360 degrees higher above the horizon. The difference was, the yellow was not the same intensity all around. Some angles were shaded toward orange.
Same issue. Low angle shots. But if the target is in a yellow zone, we can effectively hit it if we coordinate the strike with another cannon cluster.
Jesse grinned.
Interesting. You see where I'm going with this, Lou?
No. He tapped her on the shoulder, then tapped the display with a finger.
Can you create a test target here in this yellow zone?
A fake one, just to test the system?
Sure.
She had to play with the unfamiliar system until targeting circles appeared in the area Jesse wanted. Below the circle was a number, reading 73.
73% probability of destroying the target? He guessed.
Correct.
Great. Move it down and to the north. The number changed to 52.
Now we're getting somewhere, Jesse muttered.
Lou didn't understand.
How?
Math, Sergeant. Trigonometry. Something like that. Think about it. A target there can be destroyed if two cannon clusters work together. Move the test target down into the orange zone.
Lou did, surprised to see the system state the confidence level went up to 84%.
How did it increase?
Because the target is too low for us, but closer to the cannons we're coordinating with.
Lou, we know where we are, and we know the location of the test target, right?
If we collect enough data points on the level of confidence,
she sucked in a breath.
We can triangulate where the other cannon must be.
Pretty close, yeah. Enough to give the fleet a rough idea where they are.
Whew. That's tricky math.
Don't worry about it. I'll get more people in here. Let's collect data points.
He snapped his fingers to get the attention of people lingering in the hallway.
We'll text the data to General Ross, and they can crunch the numbers, or get the fleet to do it.
The fleet's ops officer updated the tactical plot with the information received by General Ross after the starship's AI had analyzed the data. Four circles appeared on the outline of the planet below.
This is disappointing, Kuhn said.
Three of the circles were too large. They covered too much area. The fourth circle was almost a dot, identifying the exact location of the cannon cluster controlled by Perkins, a location the fleet already knew.
It was clever thinking, Wogolin stated.
Yes, Kuhn agreed. The humans are again proving to be annoyingly innovative. Just this time, not enough.
We would need planet busters to be sure of taking out the cannons in such a wide area, Wogolin observed.
That's not an option.
Kuhn shook his head. It wasn't an option for two reasons. The rules of engagement did not allow him to use weapons of that yield against the surface. As a consequence, the fleet wasn't carrying any such weapons.
Three circles, besides the one where Perkins is with her team. Why not five other sites?
The AI assumes the other two sites are too far away for Perkins' cannons to coordinate with.
That, or there are only three other surviving cannon clusters.
Wogolin cocked his head.
That is a risky,
too risky an assumption.
The assault transports had completed boarding the second wave and were awaiting his signal. He couldn't give the signal, knowing five plasma cannon clusters were threatening to blast the assault ships out of the sky.
We could send assault ships in one at a time, with a pair of battleships between them and the cannons, Wogolin suggested.
Those cannons would burn bright through even a battleship's shields at that altitude,
Kuhn rejected the idea.
In the initial bombardment, the battleships had jumped in at a safe distance and launched dozens of railguns at each cannon cluster. That technique worked only because the Torgala had provided precise coordinates of the cannons. Secondary explosions at the sites had confirmed the railgun darts struck their intended targets, boosting the confidence of the Ruhar. Boosting their confidence too much, apparently.
Plus, there are likely two cannon clusters we can't locate.
Each cluster can only shoot once.
They only need to shoot once.
Kuhn shook his head.
We would be trading a ship for each cluster. That math isn't in our favor.
Yes, sir.
Damn it.
The Admiral thumped a fist on the display.
Signal to Ross that it was a nice try, but we can't land the second wave.
Should we prepare to retreat under fire?
Wogolin asked.
Not yet. We have the same problem with an evac. We can't risk sending in assault transports. The dropships pulling out the ground force would have to fly beyond plasma cannon range to the other side of the planet before a transport ship could pick them up. That increases the cycle time for each dropship. We can't do it. Not unless the situation becomes desperate.
Wogolin nodded and turned away to send the message to Ross. He did not remind the Admiral that Ross already considered the situation on the verge of being desperate.
The human general officer estimated the force had only enough ammunition to continue fighting for another 36 hours, and that was entirely on the defensive. The Legion was not able to conduct offensive operations. By that measure, the invasion had already failed.
"Sorry," Perkins said after she told her team that the information they provided was not accurate or complete enough to pinpoint the location of the other cannon clusters.
"That was good initiative, good judgment, good work, people," she told the team who were standing, shaking their heads and looking down at the floor.
"Shit," Jesse spoke for all of them.
"Staff Sergeant," Perkins said quietly, motioning him to follow her over to where Lou was seated.
"It's not your fault. That was damned good thinking. Admiral Kuhn sent his compliments."
"Not good enough," Jesse said bitterly.
"Work with me here. Lou, what did you find?"
The sergeant pulled up a different menu.
"It looks like we can get targeting sensor feeds from other sites. I thought if we can get a view of the sky from each cluster, we can identify where they are."
"Okay," Jesse snorted. "Why hadn't he thought of that? Let's do that."
"But," Lou warned, "we have to request the data through the system. That creates an alert, and we'd be flagged, probably locked out of the system before the data was sent back to us. There's a time lag."
Perkins bit her lip.
"I knew this was too good to be true." "It's not all bad, ma'am. Unless I am totally wrong about how this thing works," Lou waved a hand toward the consoles around her. "We can fire the cannons independently from here. There is a protocol for isolating this site from the others. Once I do that..."
"It sends out an alert, yeah," Perkins frowned.
"Great. We have control of an enemy super weapon that we have no use for, and we can't tell the hamsters upstairs where the other cannons are."
"It's not all bad, Colonel,"
Lou cringed.
"We have..."
Jesse stopped listening while the Colonel and Sergeant discussed the situation and their limited options. Non-existent options as far as he was concerned. The whole operation had been a bust, a waste of lives and time. He wished Shauna were here. She would know what to do, making him look like a dim-witted fool in the process. He didn't care. He just wanted to see her again. He wanted to know that she was alive. If Shauna were there, he was sure she would cut to the heart of the problem with laser-like focus and... lasers.
"Shit!"
"Coulter?"
Perkins stared at him.
"You have something to share?"
"Lou,"
he leaned over her shoulder, "you can request feeds of sensor data from other sites?"
"Yes,"
she answered slowly, thinking Jesse had missed everything she said earlier.
"What about active sensors? Don't these plasma cannons use a laser beam for guidance, give them exact location and range to the target right before they fire?"
"Yes, but can you request other sites to paint a target with active sensors?"
"Oh."
She understood what Jesse was talking about.
"I don't know. Let me..."
Jesse and Perkins were silent while the sergeant worked, toggling from one menu to another. She swore in Chinese when she found what she was looking for.
"Yes, there is a protocol for requesting another site to provide active targeting data if this site's system is inoperative. It looks like..."
She leaned forward to read the display.
"Any site can request active targeting from any other site."
Jesse crossed fingers behind his back for good luck.
"The request, is it voice, text, whatever, to the squids in the other control centers, or is it automated?"
Lou glanced at the console for confirmation.
"Automated. The system is designed to operate remotely if the control center for a cannon cluster is disabled."
Perkins straightened, looking at the ceiling and holding up a finger for silence while she thought.
"Are the two of you telling me we can remotely cause other cannon sites to send active sensor pulses? The personnel on site can't stop it?"
"They can stop it, I think."
Lou's eyes narrowed.
"After they realize what is happening. Not at first. The automated system is too fast for the squids to intervene. We would have a couple seconds, maybe."
Perkins shared a smile with Jesse.
"A couple seconds is all the fleet will need to pinpoint the location of the other sites. Outstanding work, the two of you."
"If this works, ma'am,"
Lou cautioned,
thinking she had dug a deep hole for herself if it didn't work. The Ruhar will need to have battleships ready to fire the instant they detect the targeting laser pulses.
Ma'am,
Lou did not relish the role of party pooper.
I think we have a problem. In a simulation, I can create a virtual target, but the other sites won't send out a real active sensor pulse unless they have a real target to paint above us. Somebody needs to park a ship in orbit to act as a target.
Oh, Jesse groaned. I wouldn't want to be aboard that ship, he added.
We'll let our furry friends worry about that, Perkins said as she pulled out her Z-phone. I need to give Ross the good news.
How sure are you this will work?
Ross was clearly skeptical.
That's a damned big vulnerability in their system.
It's intended as a failover mechanism, Perkins explained. A control center can act as backup for other cannon clusters if the primary control center is offline. The squids have a reputation for poor cybersecurity, but in this case, they just didn't expect an enemy to have physical access to their network.
Can we use that access to shut down, disable the other sites?
No. We could send the command from here, but the shutdown process takes long enough that the personnel on site would intervene.
He was still not convinced.
They can't intervene in a request for an active sensor pulse?
Not according to the system manual we found. It's been accurate so far.
Your team read the manual for an alien system?
It's translated. The Wirgalan apparently believe in the KISS principle.
She meant the acronym, Keep It Simple, Stupid. Their instructions are clear and simple.
Sir, we won't know for sure whether it will work until we try it for real.
That's what bothers me. If you send the command and we don't see 5 laser pulses illuminating the...
15 pulses, sir, she reminded him. Each cluster has 3 cannons.
Okay, 15 lasers. If the hamsters upstairs don't see the other 5 sites pinpointed, this is all or nothing, and you will have given away your location to the squids. Perkins, I'll talk to Admiral Kuhn. In the meantime, I want your people out of there. Get a safe distance away.
I can't pull everyone out, sir. We can't put the command on a timer. It has to be sent in real time.
He wanted to tell her to risk the life of only one person to press the appropriate buttons. He knew she would never accept that. Neither would he. So he didn't give an order that wouldn't be obeyed.
Use your best judgment, Colonel.
All right. I need to persuade Kuhn to give this a shot.
That isn't the biggest problem, sir. Like I said, the Admiral needs to use one of his ships as a lure for targeting. That's going to be a tough sell. If you think it will help, I can talk to—
Nah, Ross snorted. Leave that to me. I have an idea. Perkins.
Yes?
I have a bit of good news for you. We located part of your team. Chaika, Jarrett, Chowdhury, Jaitz, and Cadet Dandurf landed safely.
What?
She had to lean on a console for support. Her knees felt shaky. David Chaika was alive.
How?
It's a long story. You can ask them. They're in a dodo. I'll send them to your location after we see if this scheme of yours allows us to destroy the other cannon clusters.
Persuading Admiral Kuhn to commit his ships to a dubious operation based on the alleged ability of humans to operate unfamiliar alien high-tech equipment was going to be difficult. Getting the Admiral to dangle one of his warships as a lure because a group of human ground pounders said that was necessary would be nearly impossible. Ross decided not to waste everyone's time in a futile argument. He needed a warship to volunteer for the hazardous mission. So he called Admiral Cacrondo directly before he gave the news to the commander of the 7th Fleet. Basically, he dumped the problem in Cacrondo's lap to become a headache for the Cristang Admiral. Cacrondo's dilemma was not in finding a ship to volunteer. His problem was that all of his ships volunteered immediately, and he had to select one without being seen as playing favorites. Each captain explained why their ship should be chosen, with reasons ranging from the mildly plausible to outrageous boasts. Some captains, bolder or more realistic or more desperate than the others, offered bribes, expressed in both subtle and flagrant fashion. In the end, he granted the crew of the destroyer Battle of Hungorostad the honor of jumping into low orbit to act as a lure. The selection of that ship was not due to a bribe Kakrondo didn't care about, but because the crew of that ship had somehow quickly composed an epic poem about how their little ship had sacrificed itself for the good of the Achakai nation. The admiral had to admire the effort, if not the actual content of the poem. He was also curious to see how the poem would be revised if the Hungorostad survived. Once the decision was announced, Kakrondo consoled crews of the other ships with the promise that he had an even more important and dangerous mission for them. Then he waited impatiently for the Ruhar fleet commander to make the obvious decision. To Admiral Kuhn, the decision was anything but obvious.
Wogalen,
he asked his operations aide quietly while the two stood in an alcove for at least the illusion of privacy.
What do you think? Should we trust the humans know what they are doing down there? Their idea to identify the locations of the other plasma cannons was clever thinking, even if it did fall short of the accuracy needed.
Clever, yes. Useful?
The ops officer shook his head.
We don't know. Until we know whether their technique actually identified cannon sites, it is simply an interesting mathematical exercise. The data makes sense. But we don't know what assumptions the humans made when they obtained the data points. The results could be invalid due to an error we have no way to evaluate.
He found it difficult to trust the abilities of a species who had harnessed the use of electricity less than 10 generations ago. A species that was still using chemical rockets when their planet had been conquered by the Kristang. A species that, other than the small population living on the southern continent of a Ruhar world, might be extinct.
Still, Kuhn asked, would you have thought to plot the location of other cannons based on strike probabilities? I would not, and I came up through the fleet as a gunnery specialist. The humans? Not all of them, he added. Some of them, such as these Mavericks, they have proven to be innovative and resourceful.
He thought a moment while Wogalin stood by silently, knowing the admiral would seek his counsel if he wanted it.
Yes, Kuhn made up his mind. I am willing to give this Perkins another opportunity.
It is a risk, sir.
A risk? Yes. There is also risk in not acting. The current situation is a stalemate, Wogalin. It cannot continue. We must regain the initiative. Of the options available to me, what Ross proposes yields the greatest potential reward for the lowest risk.
Admiral, right now the cannon cluster occupied by Perkins is an asset the enemy doesn't know we have. If the Wergalin fleet comes back, those cannons could destroy enemy ships, leaving our ships free to maneuver. Once Perkins attempts to command the other sites to send out a laser pulse, their secret will be exposed.
Kuhn smiled, tilting his head.
You trust the humans to activate, target, and successfully fire a cannon, but not to request a sensor pulse.
When you say it like that, I see your point, sir.
Inform Ross that I have tentatively approved his plan. We must discuss timing. I need to speak with my captains.
Admiral,
Operations Officer Wogalin spoke while his superior was talking with the captains of his battleships, cruisers, and the leaders of the 3 destroyer squadrons.
What?
Kuhn knew his aide would not have interrupted him unless it was important.
It's official. The Achakai have formally requested the honor of acting as target.
They have, eh?
Kuhn's mouth twisted in a broad smile.
Did you all hear that?
He directed that remark to the holographic images of his ship captains.
Apparently, we have a volunteer.
The captains all laughed, to one degree or another.
Stand ready to fire when you detect the laser pulses.
Chapter 24 The Achakai destroyer Battle of Hungorostad waited anxiously for the signal from the Ruhar fleet, with the crew aware all the ships in the area were watching their every move and that even the slightest imperfection would be noted and commented on. Criticism by the Ruhar would of course be harsh, and make no allowances for the fact that the Achakai were new to the profession of operating starships, nor would allowances be made that the Assassin's Guild were flying Wergalan ships, ships that had until recently been mothballed in a boneyard. The crew of the Hungorostad understood the Ruhar would be critical, and although they were eager to make a good impression to the traditional enemies of their species, in truth, they did not really care what the Furry Ones thought of them. The Hungorostad's crew also did not care what the Ruhar, the humans, or the Verdkris thought of them. They were very much eager to impress their fellow Achakai, whether on the other ships in their newly established fleet, on the ground, or waiting in assault carriers for their opportunity to put boots on the ground and get into action. To their fellow members of the Assassin's Guild, the Hungorostad carried the burden not only of being first in action, but of carrying the hopes of an entire people. If the ship's mission failed, the second wave of the invasion might be cancelled, and the most fervent hope of every Achakai who had ever lived, the hope of regaining honor, would be lost forever. If the Hungorostad failed, it would not be for lack of courage or determination. The little destroyer's crew waited patiently, having quieted their minds with meditation. The battleships and cruisers of the Ruhar maneuvered into position just beyond effective range of the deadly plasma cannons, ready to rain hellfire down on the widest possible coverage of the continent below. At the point when even the most patient of the Hungorostad's crew wondered just what the hell the hamsters were doing, the signal came, and the destroyer jumped within a millisecond of the scheduled time. In a wild burst of gamma rays that was characteristic of Wergalan jump drives, the destroyer emerged at a temptingly low altitude, having to burn its engines at 70% thrust to avoid falling deeper into the thin atmosphere. Simply by surviving the jump, the destroyer had accomplished the first part of its mission, and with nothing else to do, the crew had received permission to provide close space support to a Verdkris unit on the ground. Those 53 Verd soldiers, the remains of what had been a company-sized force, were threatened by two enemy platoons that were reinforced by artillery. With the Verds having exhausted their own artillery and drones, they had no means of hitting back with counter-battery fire and were steadily being chopped up. The Hungorostad's crew intercepted communications from the Wergalan on the ground. The squids were excited about the presence of what was clearly one of their own ships and calling for rapid strikes to finish off the invaders. The Wergalan were therefore extremely disappointed when the destroyer began firing on their positions. "That's our signal." Perkins flashed a thumbs up to Lou, who had already seen the Achakai ship jump in over their heads and had a finger poised over